minds. The U.S. says both pressure and diplomatic options are on the table for dealing with North Korea after Pyongyang rejected talks with Washington, unless it changes course. A leaked U.S. memo details plans by the administration of President Joe Biden to reset ties with the Palestinian Authority. The UN report warns about COVID-19 lasting economic consequences and calls for continued global efforts to counter the disease. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour, the United States says both pressure and diplomatic options are on the table for dealing with North Korea.
President Biden plans to complete a North Korea policy review in the weeks ahead in close coordination and consultation with the Republic of Korea, with Japan, with other key partners, including reviewing pressure options and potential for future diplomacy.
Blinken also stressed the U.S. commitment to the denuclearization of North Korea. He made the remarks in a joint briefing with South Korean officials in Seoul. This comes shortly after a senior North Korean diplomat rejected any talks with the U.S. until Washington withdraws its hostile policies towards Pyongyang. Cho Sun-hui said Pyongyang has only heard, quote, lunatic theory of threats from the new U.S. administration, former U.S. President Donald Trump, and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un met twice in 2018 and 2019 for talks. But the negotiations failed as Washington refused to relieve any sanctions in return for Pyongyang's goodwill measures. Political commentator Timothy Kurzweil says Washington's track record has made it unreliable for North Korean officials.
What it means to deal with North Korea. I mean, the notion that you're dealing with a sovereign state is an interesting position to take for goodwill negotiations like the one that they're supposed to be proposing, isn't it? I think it's likely that this whole issue is going to not really go anywhere. I mean, from the perspective of the DPRK, why would you want to negotiate with the United States, a country, you know, while it's doing what it's doing? I mean, it's seen the track record in the past. You know, the Libya gets disarmed and then regime changed and overthrown. You know, Iran enters into a deal with the United States about its nuclear program, and its top generals and nuclear scientists get assassinated. Without the United States withdrawing the pressure that it's already applying, what's in it for the DPRK to enter into any kind of negotiation with the United States? It just doesn't make much sense.
China has warned that the U.S. that it will not make any compromise on its sovereignty and security ahead of talks between the two countries. Foreign Ministry spokesman Zhao Lijian urged Washington to stop talking tough and engaging in, quote, megaphone diplomacy towards Beijing. He said the U.S. Should meet China halfway and conduct the dialogue in a sincere and constructive manner. On Wednesday, Washington said it intends to show its firmness against Beijing. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and the White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan are set to meet with senior Chinese official Yang Jiechi and Foreign Minister Wang Yi in Alaska. It's the highest level face-to-face diplomatic meeting between the two countries since U.S. President Joe Biden took office. The Kremlin says the new U.S. administration has no interest in improving its strained relations with Moscow after President Joe Biden likened his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin to a killer. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov called Biden's statements very bad. He said such remarks show that Washington doesn't want to get its ties with Moscow back on track. Russian parliament members also called Biden's comments unacceptable and a watershed moment in the relations between the two countries. On Wednesday, Biden described Putin as a killer, adding that he will pay the price for meddling in the U.S. election. The remarks followed an American intelligence report claiming that Putin had directed efforts to swing the U.S. presidential race in favor of Donald Trump. And the new U.S. administration is reportedly planning to review Washington's policies toward the Israeli occupation of Palestine. A memo which revealed to an Arab Daily says the Biden administration will push for a two-state solution based on the pre-1967 lines with mutually agreed land swaps. The memo shows the United States is planning to announce a $15 million aid package for Palestinians to deal with the coronavirus pandemic. Washington also plans to roll back some policies such as U.S. Legitimizing of Israeli settlement activities in the occupied territories. The previous U.S. administration, under President Donald Trump, had given the green light to Israel to embark on its agenda, including settlement constructions. Washington also relocated its embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem al-Quds in a move that sparked international outcry. In Bahrain, four children arrested in February ahead of protests marking 10 years since the country's uprising are still in custody. Human rights organizations say they've been interrogated without their lawyers present and threatened with rape and electrocution. Bianca Raimi has more.
On the 14th of February, Bahrain marked 10 years since the uprisings that rippled through the region. As a preemptive measure, the authorities used arbitrary arrests and intimidation to deter people from protesting. Some of those detained were children as young as 13. Human Rights Watch says they were interrogated for hours without a lawyer or parents present. Four of those children remain in detention.
They were threatened with rape. They were threatened to have, and one of the guards brought in a car battery, and the child was threatened that he would be connected to the car battery for electric shock on the genitals. And they've been told that they will be kept until they're 15 so that they can be tried as adults. They've been beaten, stripped, abused, spat on.
Earlier this month, 633 out of the EU Parliament's 689 deputies voted in favour of a resolution that calls on Bahrain to release human rights defenders and prisoners of conscience unconditionally and immediately halt 26 imminent executions. Bahrain's response to the EU resolution has been explosive.
The EU resolution blatantly overlooked the progress made by Bahrain in protecting and promoting human rights, ensuring basic freedoms, focusing only instead on limited cases without investigating them accurately.
The European Parliament does represent the European people. They are not monarchs and colonial powers. They are listening to the people, and we have agency through democracy. They do not have that in Bahrain. No matter how much Formula One and sports washing they engage with, no matter how much of these green energy, whitewashing, greenwashing seminars and events they host in the Gulf region, these are colonial placemen who continue to lock up women. Look at what's happening with the princesses of the regimes around the Gulf. They continue to abuse children and to affect sectarianism within their own countries in order to ignite dissent, to ignite a response from the people so that they can be seen as legitimate peace brokers in their countries.
The US and the UK, which both have military bases in Bahrain, are actively bolstering the kingdom's rulers by selling them arms. EU countries are not averse to receiving billions of dollars in exchange for military hardware either. Rights groups are urging them all to ensure they are not funding abuse, but so far those calls have fallen on deaf ears. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Yemen's Ministry of Foreign Affairs has slammed the international community and the United Nations for their failure to take the necessary action to bring peace to the country. A correspondent in Sana'a, Abdul Latif Al-Washali, has more.
Amid the UN's failure to end the years-long war in Yemen, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Sana'a held a press conference to blast the UN brokered peace negotiations aimed at reaching a political solution to the Yemen crisis, as they have produced no tangible results.
The United Nations still expresses its concern only, although it represents the will of the influential countries in the Security Council. It says it brings together the parties to the conflict to present their initiatives together, but it should work in accordance with the Charter of the United Nations and live up to the international treaty entrusted to it. The UN should also not be swayed by the countries that finance and control the organization.
Officials say the UN is facing blackmail from Saudi Arabia as it receives its funding from the kingdom. Riyadh has pushed the organization to stop committing to its promise of lifting the blockade on Yemen The kingdom is also pressuring the UN to keep providing political cover-up for Saudi Arabia for its illegal actions, which includes the continued detention of oil ships.
Unfortunately, the United Nations and regional organizations have had a negative role regarding the issue of aggression against Yemen. Their role is affected by Saudi blackmail and money. Moreover, arms companies also have a role in the attacks on Yemen that have targeted its potentialities and infrastructure, all because Yemen wanted to get rid of the Saudi domination and maintain its sovereignty and political independence and preserve its financial resources.
Yemen has been suffering under the Saudi war and siege since the beginning of 2015, which has killed over 200,000 deaths, including civilians.
The war on Yemen is approaching its seventh year, and there are no signs yet of any political solution to end the sufferings of the Yemenis, and the United Nations continues to remain silent on what it has described as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The International Atomic Energy Agency says it has confirmed that Iran has begun operating a cascade of advanced centrifuges at an underground site. IAEA Director General Rafael Grossi told member delegations that Iran has, quote, begun feeding a newly installed cascade of 174 IR-4 centrifuges. He said the installation in the pilot fuel enrichment plant near Natanz is aimed at enriching uranium hexafluoride gas up to 5% U-235 uranium. According to Grossi, Iran has also indicated it plans to install a second cascade in the Natanz facility. There have been no comments from Tehran yet on Grossi's remarks. And the UN Conference on Trade and Development says the COVID-19 pandemic will have lasting economic consequences. In a report, the UN body said there was a 3.9% drop in output last year as the spread of the coronavirus sparked lockdowns across the world. It called the impact exorbitant, describing the destruction of income on an unprecedented scale, with people in developing countries particularly hard hit. It said the crisis is still very serious and the recovery is not over. The report called for continued government support. It said the crisis would have been worse had central banks not taken preemptive actions to avoid financial meltdown. Political commentator Rodney Shakespeare says the world economy was already in a bad situation before the outbreak of COVID-19, and the coronavirus has made the situation worse.
This is not a good faith warning. It's a bad faith warning, pointing out that the situation was very bad beforehand, and that when at some stage in the future there's going to be a great big crash, they are going to blame it all on the coronavirus. And they're not looking at the structural failures, which have been there long before 2008. And I just remind you that debt levels are now higher than what they were in 2008. Well, you see, they're not actually addressing the problem of the economy, except by printing fantastic amounts of printed money, which keeps the party going a bit longer, but doesn't solve the underlying problem. The virus undoubtedly is very, very bad, and they've just swindled money at it. But none of that has actually corrected structural problems.
Myanmar's military junta has leveled new corruption charges against the country's ousted leader, Aung San Suu Kyi. On Wednesday, the military aired a video of a Myanmarese businesswoman confessing to giving Suu Kyi more than $500,000 U.S. dollars over the span of several years. The businessman said that he had donated money to senior government figures for the good of his business, but Suu Kyi's lawyer slammed the charges as groundless and illogical. Last week, the military had also accused her of another corruption case involving $600,000 and 10 kilos of gold. The southeastern Asian country has been in chaos since February's coup that led to the detention of top officials. The military has also unleashed a bloody crackdown on protesters demanding the return of civilian rule. Five people have been killed and over a dozen others injured in a roadside bomb explosion in the Afghan capital, Kabul. The blast came hours before a Russia-sponsored peace talk. on Afghanistan and Moscow. Our correspondent Tim Kobel, I mean, let me join us earlier to give us more details about the incident.
The Kabul residents began their day once again with a huge explosion. This time, this incident happened in the northern part of this city. According to Kabul police, a magnetic bomb blast has hit a minibus carrying the employees of Afghanistan's communication ministry. This incident has happened in Police District 17 in Khairkhana area. However, none of terrorist groups, including the Taliban or Daesh, has claimed responsibility for this incident. In the meantime, Afghanistan's Interior Ministry says that a wide-range operation is underway across big cities of Afghanistan, mainly here in the Afghan capital, Kabul, to find the main sources of the launchers of such attacks. However, Afghanistan's National Directorate of Security also says that the Taliban militant group is behind launching such attacks that claims the lives of civilian employees of the Afghan government, not only those people, but also rural Afghans, mainly women and children, are being killed on a daily basis as a result of rising violence and bloodshed.
There's no end in sight to the sufferings of thousands of missing citizens in Pakistan. The systematic and forced disappearances started after Islamabad joined the so-called U.S. War on Terror over 20 years ago. Javed Ranaz, more from Islamabad.
These are helpless parents in this protest held in Pakistan's capital, Islamabad. They have a tragic story which they say no one is willing to listen in Pakistan. Their two sons, one after the other, disappeared. One of them disappeared 7 years ago, while the another one just last week. They have no clue about the whereabouts of their sons.
If my sons are found guilty, the government must punish them, but if not, then must set them free. But no one in the government listens to us. We don't know what to do.
This is just tip of the iceberg of the tragedy of the victims of thousands of similar cases of enforced disappearances. It all started in late 2001 when the US-led NATO forces invaded neighboring Afghanistan and Islamabad joined their so-called war on terror. Pakistan's secret services have been at the heart of allegations to have illegally detained citizens under the cover of so-called war on terror. A significant number among the detained citizens were allegedly secretly handed over to the US. The repeated demands of the victim families to either prosecute their loved ones or set them free have gone unheard in Pakistan. Despite promises to set them free, the successive civilian governments and judiciary have done little to help the victim families. The country's military-run secret services have mostly defied the orders of Pakistan's penal courts to release the missing citizens, languishing in jail for years, some of them well over a decade, without any charge sheet.
There's no power with the politicians. There's no power with the democracy in Pakistan. They cannot ask them. There's no accountability of the intelligence agencies for doing illegal activities. They are out of the ambit of law. They can do anything. Any army person, any uniformed person can just blame anybody and that person will be disappeared. That person will be in jail.
In a controversial move, Pakistan's parliament provided blanket immunity to the secret services in 2014 from prosecution on the charges of illegal detention, torture, and killing of citizens. Nonetheless, this did not bring any significant let-up in enforced disappearances in Pakistan. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Live coverage of Nowruz in Arabi English Radio.
On Saturday, March 20th, around 9:30 UTC.
Stay with us.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Oklahoma City, directed by Barack Goodman. And joining me in the studio, we have Mike McCahill, who is a film and television critic for The Guardian, The Telegraph, and many other outlets. And beside him is Matt Turner, who is the senior editor of Evolve Politics. Now, in 1995, Timothy McVeigh, a former soldier deeply influenced by far-right ideology, detonated a truck full of explosives in front of the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City. This resulted with 168 people killed, including 19 children, and 675 injured in the blast. This documentary traces the events, including the deadly encounters between U.S. citizens and law enforcement at Ruby Ridge and Waco that led to McVeigh to commit the worst act of domestic terrorism in U.S. history.
There's heavy damage. About a third of the building has been blown away.
The bombing in Oklahoma City was an attack on defenseless citizens.
I could hear yelling, screaming. He said, "You can't go up there, it's too dangerous." But I just kept saying, "Our baby's hard now."
And I thought, who has come in here and done this terrible thing?
FBI hotline.
We had all kinds of experts looking for clues.
Because at the very first, they had no idea who did it.
Then we started getting calls about Middle Easterners, start looking for Middle Easterners.
But then someone I spoke to said, "Do you know what day it is?" And immediately it hit me. This is about Waco.
Members of the community out there had heard automatic weapons fire and explosions coming from the compound.
Pick up the phone. There goes here. I want to speak with you.
You went back on your word.
That is a lie.
When I saw the fire, all I could think about were the children in there.
Nine adults came out. Not one of them brought a child out.
You're next! Wake up and understand! You're next!
They were really imagining this fortress.
It's the new thing in America. It's called the militia. No constable's going to come and break their door down. They'll shoot them first.
FBI agents surround the cabin.
At that point, there was a shootout.
When it was all said and done, Sammy and Vicki Weaver were dead.
Any cure! Any cure!
The events at Ruby Ridge lit up the radical right.
Call yourself an American? These are Americans!
You're a disgrace to the white race!
And they decided that they would basically declare war on the U.S.
There'll be a lot of blood running one day.
It was just the lightning moment of recognition. This was the guy in the sketch.
Last night, Timothy McVeigh was charged in the bombing of the Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City.
I think everybody felt this sudden sense of betrayal. I think everyone thought, you're one of us.
If you continue with shit like Ruby Ridge and Waco, this is what's going to happen.
Timothy McVeigh, he was the creation of the white supremacist movement. There was a strong connection.
All these events, they were all connected.
First of all, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, Oklahoma City was a documentary that provided a great insight into the psyche of white supremacists, and also it was incredibly detailed in the events leading up to the devastating Oklahoma City bombing itself. Mike, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on Oklahoma City?
Well, it's made by PBS, which, of course, is the American Public Service broadcaster, and I think it has a recognisable PBS style. So you get reels of archive footage broken up by talking heads, expert talking heads, and sort of slow rostrum camera pans over white supremacist text and photographs that show the consequences of the actions of people like McVeigh. So I think it's good TV rather than something especially cinematic, but what it does have is this very strong procedural hook. It's chaptered. Every chapter has a title like The Flame, The Spark, The Inferno, and there is a sense that after some extremely heated explosive activity. We're going to have this reassertion of cool rationality. We're going to look at these events from a distance, from a historical perspective, and look
PBS
at...
PBS seem to be really great at these sort of things.
Yeah, exactly. It's exactly what they
do. Similar films in the past.
Yes, I think, you know, bringing that sort of cool-headedness to a hot-headed act of violence and seeing Oklahoma as this tragic endpoint at the end of a chain of events that really need to be learned from.
And Matt, what did you make of Oklahoma City?
Well, to be honest with you, I think, given the current circumstances in the United States, I think it should be shown in every classroom in America, because it does really teach you the dangers of how white supremacists can take advantage of young, disillusioned men who are probably, you know, skeptical about government involvement in their own lives anyway.
So following just what Mike said, do you think this documentary then has high relevance to today, even though this happened over 20 years ago?
I think now more than ever, it's been completely and utterly relevant. I mean, if you look at the rise of Donald Trump, you look at the rise of white supremacy in the United States, you know, they are gaining momentum again, and they are kind of emboldened by the rise of the alt-right. You know, we are seeing more and more militias kind of coming back.
Exactly.
And we're kind of reaching a really, really dangerous territory now where you can kind of feel the tension when you go on alt-right marches and white supremacist marches. Neo-Nazis used to be hidden in the shadows, probably ever since this attack for the last 20 years, but now they're starting to come back out and starting to be a little bit more vocal.
In the mainstream, especially.
Ruby Ridge, more even than Robert Matthews in The Order, became a central calling card and rallying card for the far right. For them, the government was after Weaver's guns and his religion. And guns and religion became the twin pillars of the white supremacist movement.
In late summer 1992, after Ruby Ridge, several members of the extremist movement saw that as an opportune moment to sort of gather everybody together and let's raise hell about this.
One race, one vote, one nation, one people, one homeland, we're going to have it!
Louis Beam, a former Grand Dragon of the Ku Klux Klan, said, now is the time for you as an individual to commit overt acts of anti-government violence. Essentially, anybody representative of government or law enforcement was a fair and reasonable target.
The government is an enemy of the people. And in this war, it's an all or nothing. You know, we either going to win as the white race or we're going to lose.
Kind of extremist thinking coming from the white supremacists there. And Mike, what else did we learn about white supremacists from this documentary? How do you think they were portrayed?
Well, I mean, we were talking about other PBS documentaries. The PBS documentary this most reminded me of was the Ken Burns film about the Civil War, you know, sort of landmark documentary series. Mm-hmm. Because it, in some respect, it's as though history keeps repeating itself. Like, so there are people in the impoverished South of America who now look at, you know, late 20th, 21st century America, which is a place of integration, which is a place where there are multiple voices, where everybody seems to have a place, there's a place for everyone. And they look at that and they say, well, actually, I'd much rather live in the America of the 17th, 18th, 19th century, you know, where there was this white Christian monoculture and everybody knew their place. And I think, you know, we speak about white power. I think actually white power is white anger, the fact that, you know, things aren't what they used to be.
And I just wanted to go back to the documentary now and talking about Timothy McVeigh. What did you make of his character and how is he portrayed in the film?
Well, he's a fascinating character because, you know, in many ways, he's the ultimate patriot. You know, he served his country during the first Iraq war. I think his story chimes with that of a lot of people, a lot of soldiers who were sent out to Iraq and came back and started questioning their own place in American society, that they were a tool of the state, and they were useful so long as they were fighting certain battles out there. What do they do once they're back on the home front, and the government seems to have abandoned them? And so he's a patriot who comes to turn against his own country, which is a sort of central irony of this documentary.
And Matt, if I could turn to you and ask you sort of the same question about Timothy McVeigh. We see his process of radicalization. He was a former US soldier.
Yeah.
What impression did you make of this, of this radicalization process?
I thought it was really, really interesting. You know, kind of like we said, he was a soldier, he went out to serve his country, and he definitely was an arm of the state, and he came back and he became incredibly disillusioned with his life as a soldier, his life in the army. And I think the really, really dangerous thing is that there are kind of three separate strands of the far-right movement which he appears to have been radicalized by. Right, there is the kind of Christian fundamentalist side of things, as we saw in the kind of Waco siege.
Yes, in the clip it just said guns and sort of religion go hand in hand with white supremacy.
Yeah, no, definitely. You've kind of got the NRA movement, the guns, but then you've also got that kind of neo-Nazi white pride kind of movement, which does usually kind of seep its way into both the religious and the kind of gun control debates. And it's maybe, you know, once upon a time it wasn't always dominant in those debates, but now it absolutely is.
And I just wanted to bring in the point you made earlier before the other VTV played about Donald Trump. You said that we see a rise now in far-right movements, but with Timothy McVeigh, he was angry at the government then, but do you think he'd be happy with the government now if he were alive?
You know what, I think he would be happy that Donald Trump got elected, because he did run on that kind of populist right platform, something which would appeal, you know, a lot to Timothy McVeigh. But a few years down the line, when people start to realise that Donald Trump is just another careerist in the White House who isn't going to enact kind of real change in the interest of ordinary people, in the interest of kind of communities up and down America, that's when he'll start to feel even more betrayed, for example, because he's kind of put faith in the government and in a politician such as Donald Trump for once in his lifetime, hypothetically. And I think he would still be disappointed, and that's when it could get really catastrophic.
Okay, we'll just have to leave it there just for now. We'll continue the discussion in the next part.
White supremacists like Bean saw in this standoff the same issues that they had decided were important with Randy Weaver. The Branch Davidians were not white supremacists, but now a broader section of the far right sees itself in Waco and says, we're being suppressed for our beliefs and our guns.
There was a hill that was about 3 miles from Mount Carmel. It was on a rise that was high enough that you could just barely see Mount Carmel in the distance. This was as close as members of the public could get to the standoff.
You're next! You're next! Wake up and understand! You're next!
All sorts of folks felt moved to come down to see what was going on at Waco.
Just arrived today. I guess somebody told me a lot of people would be scared to put something on, you know, like this.
Timothy McVeigh had already apparently been very concerned about what had happened at Ruby Ridge. So he came down to Waco and sold bumper stickers with pro-gun, anti-government slogans. He saw the raid as clear evidence of what the government would do to try to confiscate guns and persecute gun owners.
The documentary argues that the siege at Ruby Ridge in 92 and then the Waco attacks in 93 were the primary motivations behind the Oklahoma City bombing in 95. Now, Mike, what did you make of the part in the documentary where the government gets involved in these sieges at Ruby Ridge and Waco? Was it a game changer?
It certainly was. I mean, I think, strangely enough, that part of the film reminded me of the most recent series of Homeland, the TV series, which is doing a not dissimilar storyline in terms of dealing with white supremacy and a sort of Waco, Ruby Ridge-like siege. And what that show is doing at the moment is showing just how difficult it is to enter into any kind of debate with white supremacists. And I think in part it's down to the great American love of free speech, And, you know, white supremacists, the minute they feel their voices are being suppressed, they feel like they're being censored, or, you know, they feel like they're being victimized, which leads to an even greater bunker mentality. And that, you know, the second problem here is the access to military-grade weaponry and explosives, which you don't get in any other part of the world.
They spent about $43,000 or something, and that's why they went to raid them.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's almost unthinkable on this side of the Atlantic, but it is something that recurs in American history because people do have easy access to that kind of weaponry.
And Matt, would you agree with what Mike said? And I also wanted to add that I think one of the messages in the film was that there was a lot of government complicity, and they bared a lot of responsibility in Oklahoma City bombing because of the way they mishandled the events that week on Ruby Ridge.
I'd say Ruby Ridge, absolutely. You know, it's kind of been put in official documents that the government did mishandle that situation, and that the FBI and other forces did go beyond what is kind of considered reasonable force. You know, kind of Randy Weaver was given a considerable payout afterwards. You know, he spent maybe 18 months in jail tops, I think. Wake, on the other hand, I think is an entirely different beast. You know, I think in the documentary you would actually see a recording about when the FBI were putting in tear gas and about to raid the building. The kind of Branch Davidians started pouring fuel and pouring petrol, and it basically turned into a suicide cult by the end of it. And to me, that is no fault of the government. They did have to go in there, I truly believe.
But of course the far right spins that moment and made it seem as if the government had put the fire at Waco.
And that is another reason why it's incredibly relevant in this day and age, because we are in an era of, you know, quote-unquote fake news, the rise of social media, the rise of online content, the rise of a lot more conspiracy theories, particularly on the alt-right. People believe what they read on the internet if it fits their kind of pre-existing hatred of the government. And that's why a lot of far-right conspiracy theories about Waco actually gained so much steam and definitely kind of played a part in radicalizing.
Did you want to add anything to that?
I mean, you do see it's almost the birth of fake news, you know, halfway through this film, where they're showing re-editing that footage of the storming of the compound to suggest something entirely different to the far-right demographic, you know. And you can certainly see that there's the birth of something in this incident, which still resonates even today.
It's incredibly symbolic and enlightening, actually.
The Murrah Building had numerous federal offices. It had HUD, it had the ATF, it had general accounting offices, it had military recruiters, the Social Security Administration, the DEA was in there. And there is some question as to whether or not McVeigh knew there was a daycare in there, but he also kind of indicated that it wouldn't have made the difference anyway. Michael Fortier began feeling uneasy about doing this. He suddenly visualized what was going to happen. He points out that there were probably going to be innocent people inside that are going to die.
McVeigh told him there has to be a body count. He said the government is not going to sit up and take notice unless there's a body count. They can always build a new building, but a body count will get their attention.
From a military perspective, to get a message across, you need to hurt them where they hurt the most. The only way they're going to feel something, and the only way they're going to get the message, is with a body count.
I think many might be surprised to learn that actually the Oklahoma City bombing was the biggest act of domestic terrorism in the US. And I did some research, and actually, you know, ever since 9/11, despite the focus on so-called Islamic terrorism, but since 2001, since then, the number of violent attacks on US soil inspired by far-right ideology has spiked to an average of more than 300 a year, according to a study by the Combating Terrorism Center at West Point. So Matt, why do you think it is that these attacks by white supremacists don't get as much media attention?
I think, you know, there are a lot of complex reasons for that, but I think one of the main ones is obviously we've had Bush, we've had Obama, and now we have Trump, all of which have kind of intervened in the Middle East and want to kind of justify those interventions. And the easiest way to do it, the easiest way to rally public support, is to inflate the threat to your own domestic land. and pretend that it is absolutely essential to intervene in these countries to stop attacks, when in reality, the vast majority of attacks, as you've already said, on American soil have been committed by mostly far-right, young, white men. And they don't get deemed terrorist attacks in the news. They get kind of castigated as lone wolves or mentally deranged. And then they never really want to kind of pick apart the ideology behind why these people are committing these attacks.
And Mike, do you think that this documentary implied this sort of point, this message from the film, especially by the media coverage of Waco, of Oklahoma City bombing, rather?
Oh, certainly. I mean, I think, you know, there's a very distinct segment of the film which reports the initial response to the attack, which was, you know, to suggest that this wasn't, you know, white supremacists, it was, you know, a Middle Eastern terrorist of some kind. And this seems to be a trope that happens time and time again now in the mainstream media. I think after, you know, major events happening, you know, there's always a rush to judgment, a rush to point fingers. And I think, you know, because this is such an explosive issue, having actually had that kind of, you know, to step back and to look at the facts and examine the evidence, you know, we need time to do that. And I think more and more with the way the internet and social media sped things up, people are rushing to judgment much more. You know, but this was before that, you know, and people were still pointing fingers and rushing to judgment.
So the internet probably has exacerbated that problem.
Exactly, yeah, I think so.
And why do we see then this consistent growth then of far-right ideology, despite the fact that we're sort of in the digital age and people should know better?
I'm not sure people do know better, to be honest with you. I mean, if you look at the actual volume of kind of far-right propaganda on websites like Twitter and Facebook now, you know, it is genuinely obscene. I mean, Facebook have recently decided to finally permanently ban the Britain First Facebook page, which is obviously a good start because they do kind of put forward a lot of inaccuracies, a lot of harsh
truths. But Trump actually retweeted a few of their tweets that were spreading Islamophobic messages.
He did, and I think that shows a kind of shocking lack of judgment, particularly from the President of the United States, to kind of indulge in this kind of far-right conspiratorial nonsense. But the more serious point is, you know, Donald Trump is a hugely influential man, you know, President of the United States, and the fact that he's pushing those conspiracies means that, you know, you can talk about the NRA, you can talk about the religious fundamentalists, but in reality, you know, Donald Trump right now is exacerbating the problem more than anybody else.
And we're just coming to the end of the show now. Mike, could I get your final thoughts on this film, and would you recommend it?
Oh, certainly. I mean, it is worth seeing, and, you know, it does have a huge amount of relevance to the situation we're in today. I think it's also very moving, we should say. You know, I mean, towards the end, it points at the fact that Timothy McVeigh wanted to take up arms and overturn the current government to install the government of the people. But actually, there's a final montage that shows the workers inside the Oklahoma City building, who were the people, who were fathers and mothers and daughters and sons, doing their best for their country, who happened to be in completely the wrong place at the wrong time.
Very well put, and I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camilla Chambayat.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn, alayhis salam. Now, all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. My name is Muhammad, and I'm invited by Brother Mahdi to this segment of the program. Today, I'd like to read to you a passage about Islamic lifestyle according to Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. This passage is extracted from a book titled The Life of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Baqir, written by the great Iraqi Muslim historian and scholar Allama Baqir Sharif al-Qurashi. This great Muslim scholar and historian was born in 1344 AH in the city of Najaf. He's well known for his books on the biography and conduct of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. Please stay with me. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir, peace be upon him, advised Muslims to cling to silence. He ordered them to refrain from saying useless words. He, peace be upon him, said, "Indeed, this tongue is the key of all good and evil." So the believer must seal his tongue as he seals his gold and silver. For Allah's apostle, may Allah bless him and his family, said, "May Allah have mercy of the believer who restrains his tongue from all evil, for that is alms from him for himself. No one is safe from sins unless he restrains his tongue."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. There's a very interesting conversation which is found in the historical texts of the Muslims. In this conversation, we find that Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, the sixth divinely appointed Imam, talks about a conversation which he had with his father, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, the fifth divinely appointed Imam. And so this conversation between father and son is being related by the son, i.e. Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salam, and he's talking about this conversation in another conversation with an individual by the name of Sufyan al-Thawri. Imam Sadiq says that, "O Sufyan, my father, Imam al-Baqir, ordered me to do three things and prevented me from doing three things. Among what he said to me is, 'O my little son, he who makes friends with a bad friend is not safe. Whoever enters into evil affairs is accused. And he who does not restrain his tongue is regretful.'" Very beautiful pieces of advice. One, if you make friends with a bad friend, you will never be safe for they will lead you astray, or they might deceive you, or they might take you down the wrong path. They might betray you, because they are a bad friend. 2. If you commit evil actions, if you conduct evil affairs, if you enter into bad deeds, you will be accused by the people. You will be ashamed. You will be humiliated. You will be embarrassed. It is not going to be good for you. And finally, restrain your tongue, because if we cannot restrain our tongue, then we will say things which truly, in the end, we will regret. Beautiful, profound pieces of wisdom given from a father to a son, from Imam al-Baqir to Imam as-Sadiq, and then forwarded from Imam as-Sadiq to Sufyan al-Thawri, conversation upon conversation, the source, Imam al-Baqir, alayhi salam. Now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
At least we learn a method of what is known as, you know, munazara and discussion and dialogue with others. That even though we might have a direct access and channel, but sometimes you use other sources. Not necessarily you consider them to be sahih, but at least you are using it to convince the other side. And so there is nothing wrong in looking at Sahih Bukhari or Sahih Muslim or Sahih Nisa'i or Tirmizi of Ibn Majah and others. You know, this is one example that we have from our fifth imam, as far as the hadith Saqalain is concerned. The greatness of the imam, let me just, you know, read to you two statements from the contemporaries who were not from the Shia community. One is Abdullah bin Atta al-Makki, one of the scholars among the Muslims of those days. And he says, مَا رَعِيتُ الْعُلَمَاءِ عِنْدَ عَهَدٍ قَدْتُ أَصْغَرُ مِنُهُمْ عند أبي جعفر محمد بن علي بن الحسين. He says, I have never seen ulama attending a lecture of somebody who is younger than them in age, except in case of Abi Ja'far Muhammad bin Ali bin Hussein. وقد لقد رأيت الحكم بن عطيبة مع جلالته في القوم بين يديه. He says, I saw a prominent scholar who is known for his prestige and his honor among the people by the name of Hakam bin Atayba. He says, I saw him in the presence of our fifth imam, كَأَنَّهُ صَبِيٌّ بَيْنَ يَدِ مُعَلِّمِهِ. I saw him sitting there just as a child would sit in front of his teacher. And so this was a prominent scholar, but he still felt the need to go and learn from our fifth imam, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir, alayhi salatu wassalam.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.